we see a happy number of survivors, so I guess all is well. And we hope that you will remember in general the outline that we attempted to provide at the last of these talks. We were studying the septenary nature of the causal agent at the base of life. And from the time we established this archetypal septenary, we must observe the universe unfolding according to the exact repetitions of this pattern. The pattern is modified, of course, by the particular species or type of life, but it forever re-impresses itself, forming a basic key by which all things can be estimated. This key was the great law of analogy, which was, of course, the principal instrument of ancient instruction, although in more recent times it has passed out of favor. The law of analogy, however, is still valid in a great many levels of thinking. For we do recognize, for instance, in the law of octaves, a principle of analogy. We recognize it also in our color harmonies and in our correlations between sound and color, as in certain musical instruments that have been more recently devised. This evening, however, we want to take our pattern and apply it specifically to the development of a planet. And in so doing, we remember our basic thought from before, namely that bodies come into manifestation from a circumferential field or a magnetic field, which is the true boundary or area set aside for manifestation. That creation is a process of gradual restriction or compression by means of which agencies, elements, principles, energies retire from the circumference or field to a center. And in this center, they form the objective or physical manifesting body of the structure under consideration. Thus, we have the rule which the ancients knew so well, for example, namely that bodies are not containers, actually, of souls, but souls are contained within bodies in a peculiar way. For example, always the superior must contain that which is less than itself, for all inferiors are restrictions or compressions within the spheres or areas of a superior principle. Thus, man's spirit is not in the body is in the spirit. For the spirit represents the field of energy, and the body represents a focal point set up within this field due to the gradual flowing of energies from the area of the field to a center, leaving behind what is called a privation, or an abyss, or a hell, as the ancients called it. So let us then apply this thinking to our planet system. And let us take the familiar Egyptian symbol, which was perhaps one of our earliest instruments of educational analogy, the cross-section of an onion. When the Egyptian wanted to teach his son astronomy, he simply cut an onion in half and explained the mystery to the lad, that is, in case the lad was still able to see the concentric rings. But in any event, the Egyptian pointed out that a solar system, a planet, the human magnetic field itself, each of these structures, by analogy similar, consisted of a series of concentric zones. And these zones were created or set into activity by the gradual retiral of energy from the circumference to the center. Thus we have these zones coming into existence one after another and continuing to form concentrically within each other from the outside toward the center until finally in the middle area the physical planet itself was brought into existence. Thus a planet consists of a body and a septenary of superphysical principles. This septenary of superphysical principles in the solar system was represented by the field of the planets. And the seven planets recognized by the ancients, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Sun, Venus, Mercury, and the moon and sun being regarded as planets in ancient astronomy, these represent the seven layers or spheres of the onion, represented by the cross-section of the solar system. These seven together operated upon, in, and through the Earth, which was the eighth sphere, or the eighth part of the soul. Thus the invisible bodies of a planet represented soul bodies, and its visible form, which is set up in the center, or in the midst of them, receives into itself, as into a cup, or as the ancients call it, a crater, all of the energies of the superphysical field. Now when a planet is fashioned, all of these fields of invisible energy, through a series of concentric restrictions, compress until they finally result in a pressurized area in the very center of the field of the planetary body. And this pressured area slowly begins to glow. And from this glowing, there comes into existence the nebulous, fiery body of a planet. This body is being bombarded constantly from its own magnetic field. It is being sustained like the flame of a lamp by a wick dipped deep in oil. The oil is invisible. In this case, the wick is invisible, but the flame is visible. But the life and power and energies of bodies, these are communicated to the bodies from their energy fields. And wherever a form lives, it is because of an invisible life agent behind it. And this invisible life agent is always a septenary of some kind, manifesting through an eighth sphere or eighth part, its body or vehicle. Now, if we had lived or could live many millions, hundreds of millions of years ago, when this planet was in the forming, we might have had different kinds of visions. We might have looked out into space where this planet was going to be, and had we a certain kind of extrasensory gamut, we could have seen a tremendous radiant sphere divided into concentric rings of color like a circular rainbow. These rings of vibrant light, concentric like the rings of a target. So we could have seen a blazing field of light in which the colors of the spectrum were distributed in concentric bands. Under those conditions, if our sight was focused upon this phase of the phenomenon, we would observe in the center of this, where the bullseye of the target would be, something like the bullseye, a dark, dimensionless area, a depth. A mysterious field of night. And this we could not penetrate with the same vision with which we could see this wonderful field of magnificent moving color. But if we could change our focus of vision now to a physical level, slowly all this wonderful field of light would disappear. And in its place, in the center of the target, a smoldering coal would appear. A kind of fiery, mysterious, gaseous globe. And this globe would be luminous with the power of these invisible energies. But we could no longer see them. And perhaps something resembling a small moon at sunset, when the moon is first visible as a kind of orange disk on the horizon, might be more like what we would see. And this, the ancient scientists and the more modern scientists believe to have been a planet in a molten state. It was not actually molten as we know it. It was a living entity gradually beginning to build bodies and drawing these bodies from the field of energy around it and making the body visible by consolidating the elements which compose it, compressing them. Now, we know today that we can take invisible elements in the atmosphere and by placing them under tremendous pressure, cause them to be visible. And the same thing nature was doing, causing out of an invisible material a visible one to come by bringing the parts closer and closer together. And so, ultimately, a visible form seemed to emerge from this strange field. And it emerged from darkness because the eyes that could see the form would not be able to see the light field behind it or around it. Now this form, which was to be our planet, we'll say for the moment, was of perhaps the solidity of a gaseous vapor. It was something that could support no life as we know life. It had no mountain, rock, earth, anything that we know. Were we placed upon it, we would fall through it into space. It was simply a field of semi-visible energy. Gradually, this process of consolidation continued. And through great periods of bombardment from the magnetic field around it, forcing it, making this globe continuously smaller, and in so doing, forcing the particles in closer and closer relationship to each other. And these particles coming under the controlling power of element binders, ether, energy fields of ether. Ultimately, this ball began to take on greater and greater solidity. Now, this ball was moving. It was rotating and revolving. The primary motion that concerns us was the rotation. Because as these elements and substances increased in density, rotation seems to have caused them to move toward the polar fields. Perhaps one of the reasons being that the rotation was least rapid at the polar area and most rapid at the equator. Therefore, the friction between the surface of this field of energy, the globe, and the outer space wall around it, the friction was greater at the equator, lesser at the pole. In time, this mysterious nebula, as in certain nebulas that we see in the sky today, took on a kind of what we would call dumbbell shape. It was in this case a vertical dumbbell, with its axis, the handle, running upward hypothetically toward the pole star. And this dumbbell consisted of a darker, a more semi-solid shape still existing within the globular field of mist or of this nebulous agent, which was the field of its formation. And ultimately, in the motion of this, we begin to see on this energy field globe, this kind of luminous mist body, what astronomers perhaps recognize today as the polar cap of Mars. You begin to see an area gradually differentiating from the general appearance and forming the primary indications of solidity, the arising of the solid in the midst of the dense. Because solidity, in a strange way, is the opposite of density. In the creation of these two solid zones, like caps on the two polar extremities of this luminous disk or luminous globe, we also find a parallel in the development of the fecundated ovum in the development of the embryo. When the cell fission begins in the multiplication of the cell to form the body of a human being or of an animal, the first division of cells takes place at the north pole of the original cell. And this division results in a gradual development of a cap-like structure over the pole, a single layer of cells that also ultimately becomes a multilayer structure and extends downward around the boundary of the cell. But all cells begin to multiply their cellular structures from their polar caps. And the same thing happened with the planet. By degrees, this area of so-called solidity appeared and became increasingly solid and hard, forming two gradually increasingly dense islands, one at the North Pole and one at the South Pole. It was in these areas, therefore, the polar region, that the first solid substances of what we call the planet Earth were available, called the polar continents. These were divided by most of the planetary surface as we know it, which was still in a semi-luminous, semi-fiery state, and therefore could not yet sustain life. Actually, the entire planet also was completely enveloped in a mist, which is referred to in the ancient writings as the fire mist. And could any creature have existed on it at that time, such a creature looking out from the surface of this fiery ball would have seen nothing but red reflected back to him from the mystical atmosphere around him, because he could not penetrate beyond this fire mist zone. According to the old philosophical teaching, the development of the two islands, one at the north and one at the south polar cap, resulted in the gradual incarnation of certain agencies from the auric fields, or the seven superior bodies containing within themselves this physically developing earth. In other words, as the earth developed, it became quickened. Life began to move into first the atmosphere of the earth, and finally into the physical structure itself. All forms coming into manifestation upon the surface of the earth came from its own magnetic fields, or came from the superior zones of color, the septenary structure which surrounds the earth. At the beginning, of course, these forms that were built or were gradually fashioned out of these substances had to have the same material substance in them as their world. Therefore, as the ancient reports tell us, in the beginning, beings existed that seemed to be more like flames than anything else. They were simply luminous forms, fireflies in a flame, mysterious fiery whirlwinds and swirls within the great fiery atmosphere, because the bodies could not be composed of anything separate from the material available. Had any body such as we know today been there, it would have been immediately consumed by combustion. It couldn't exist. There was a story also that when these polar caps became gradually more and more solid, that they became the abode of the first divine beings that descended from the higher atmosphere or walked down the ladder of seven rungs, or this field or zone of concentric color magnetic disks within which the earth existed. This original north polar cap was also referred to as the imperishable island, the abode of the gods, and is recognized by the Mongolians and Tatars as being the site of the mysterious Shambhala in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia. But here was the imperishable outcropping of Azoic rock, the mother rock, the parent rock of the whole earth, the oldest substance there is. And this, of course, also became the basis of the first continent, the first development of a region or an area in which life of some kind could begin to develop. Now, there's been a great deal of question and thought as to how life reached the earth. Recent researchers in outer space balloon ascensions and things of that nature, the stratosphere exploration, seem to indicate the existence in space, that is, in the space around the Earth, of free spores which have an eternal existence in space. In other words, space itself, as we call it, is filled with spore-like seeds that can be attracted or brought within the area of a planet. And therefore, that all planets can be, and probably originally were, given living organisms out of this spore field of the sun itself. Not only does the sun supply the nutrition, but the sun sustains free seeds in vacuum. And these seeds, being constantly present in space, planets and bodies moving through space, draw these within their atmospheres, and these seeds and spores fall upon the planets and begin their evolutionary development. Actually, the older teaching tells us that these spores were oozed out of the superior bodies or the invisible forms surrounding the material planets. And this would not in any way be inconsistent with the scientific thought. Now, how did these forms begin to develop upon the Earth? Obviously, the Earth had to pass through various stages, and in each of these stages, different types of forms made their appearances. Some of these forms probably lasted a few million years, perhaps some of them 1,000 million years. But the endless changing in the structure and in the pressure, the atmospheric conditions, and the temperature of the Earth resulted in a continuous modification of these forms. Needless to say, the earliest and most ancient forms survived the longest, because actually in these earlier forms there was less a compound. They were simpler structures, and compounds are the things which ultimately produce wear and tear or destruction. Also, in the beginning of forms on the Earth, reproduction was unknown. Therefore, forms had to be endowed with surviving quality. At one time, survival or reproduction became a matter of fission. Forms divided. This procedure continued until forms disappeared through infinite division. Later to this form dividing procedure was added a new dimension, namely the power of the part to grow or develop and become equal to the total. This was an entirely different type of development. Later, propagation consists of exuding egg-like structures from the surfaces of these forms. And we had a very complicated problem of how formal life began on the planet. Actually, it seems to have had its primary beginning in the process of decay. Wherever we have stagnation, the scum or film that gathers on water, wherever we have decomposition, we have the emergence of a living organism. And in the elos, as the Greeks call it, or primordial slime of space, a decomposition took place from which life came. Life in this case, of course, being formed, beginning to develop instruments for the embodiment of the energy fields behind it. Now, in the atmosphere of the Earth, we have these seven orbits. Therefore, in these seven orbits, we have a certain number of life forms developing. As far as we are able to know, in this evolutionary cycle, the life cycle of form generation on the planet resulted in the emergence of four essential types. These four essential types are what we call the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human. These four types seem to exhaust that part of the septenary body of a planet which seeks embodiment in its own physical structure. That there are three other orders of life relating to the planet, we know, but these other three orders of life do not appear physically. Therefore, they were believed by the ancients to represent angelic, archangelic beings, invisible creatures of a higher order than man, but creatures which do not become embodied and are visible, therefore, only to the mystical apperceptions or invisible faculties of the human being. But four orders of life certainly began to develop upon the physical earth as we know it. And these became one by one the instruments for the manifestation of the invisible powers of the rings or orbits that form this concatenation of worlds behind the physical. Now these bodies began to compound almost immediately. We had the mineral, and then we had the plant. And in the mineral, we had a single organism, a single body. In the plant, we have two bodies, because we also have a mineral body, and now added a vital growth factor. In the animal, we have three bodies. And in man, we have a fourfold differentiation. For in man, we have mineral, vegetable, animal, and human. And yet, although these four are combined within man, there is still around him a world containing these other kingdoms. All minerals, therefore, are not tied up in the body of man. All minerals are not tied up within the body of plants. Some minerals are in plant forms, some are in animal forms, some are in human forms, and some still remain mineral. Thus we have these lower kingdoms, or these evolving forms, existing both free and in compound. Now we know also that these various mineral elements must have their own cycles of evolution. And in the kingdoms of in nature around us, this evolution is involved in their incorporation into the structure of higher divisions or racial levels or type levels of their own kind. Thus, for instance, a mineral cycle of evolution is attained by a mineral first in its mineral state, secondly becoming incorporated in a plant, third by becoming incorporated in an animal, fourth, by being incorporated in the body of a human being, then retiring back to the disintegration of these bodies to its own root. We have a complete evolutionary arc for the mineral consciousness through its compounds. Now we also have a complete arc for the vegetable consciousness. Because we have the vegetable consciousness free in its own nature as a vegetable, then passing into compound with an animal to form the vegetable structure of an animal body, later becoming involved in the human, where it becomes part of the vegetable structure of a human body. But now we have one missing. So the plant consciousness has to proceed to a plus X, which we do not see at the top. It has to go one step higher than man in order to complete its cycle and be incorporated as a vital principle in the organism of one of the invisible hierarchs which are beyond man, and drop back again to its own level. And so we find the body or elemental principles evolving through compounds, just as man does. And the development or evolution of these is through their association with superior organisms. A simple example of what we mean, perhaps, would be the example of the person and the dog. The individual who has the dog for the pet gradually creates a sympathy with the dog. The dog's own evolution and growth is certainly advanced by its association with the human being on a constructive and sympathetic level. The dog becomes apparently almost human in its intelligent reaction, such as the seeing eye dog. It seems to take on amazing capacities and abilities. Yet actually it remains a dog. But through intimate association with the magnetic field of human beings, the animal's own growth is intensified. Just in the same way as man believes that through becoming mystically or spiritually attuned to a superior level of life, or brought into more intimate contact with great spiritual beings or gods, that man, through this association, also has his growth intensified, or is carried further upward in his own evolution by association with superior levels of consciousness. That is all we can do with that particular theme, but it opens a large subject if we want to work with it. Now, in this period where this beginning of a continental distribution was noted or was unfolding upon the polar extremities of the earth, a new series of situations also introduced themselves. The north pole of the earth became more or less, in the ancient mythologies, the abode of the suras, or spirits of light, the good spirits. The south pole became associated with the asuras, all the dark spirits, the evil powers. Therefore, two warring camps, polarization, began to be manifested. Light and darkness, good and evil, right and wrong, faith and fear, were associated psychologically with these two great zones or areas. And each one moving toward the equator, the northern continent moving downward around the sides of the globe, the southern continent moving upward around the sides of the globe, became almost like two halves gradually coming together like this to meet at the equator. The upper hand, in this case, corresponds with what we call the arterial system in the human body. The lower hand, reaching up below, became equivalent to the venous system of the body, the veins. Thus, a great system of circulation began to envelop and encircle the globe, forming in the invisible atmosphere that we see a complete group of circulational factors, an arterial system and a venous system, carried in the invisible ethers of space. As a result of this mingling of these two systems, the trunks of which extend ultimately back to the great solar heart, the sun, in magnetic fields. We have the trunks of these systems now visible to us symbolically as luminous emanations. And the arterial pole of the earth is surrounded by the spectacle which we can occasionally see, the aurora borealis, whereas the southern pole is associated with the aurora australis, or the two great magnetic poles which have to do with the earth, one of nourishment and the other of the carrying away of waste matter, one of nutrition, the other of elimination. And these two great systems flow from the sun through the structure of the earth and back to the sun again. And we have perfect parallels to this process in the arterial and venous circulation of a vital organ in the human body, and how this circulation ultimately leads back again to the sun or heart. Thus we have the earth supplied with its basic processes of nutrition and elimination, so that the poisons of the breaking down of worlds, of bodies and so forth, can be naturally carried away, whereas nutrition also becomes available constantly from the solar level of the atmosphere. Here, perhaps, is a problem that we must have to face someday. We cannot afford to put too great a strain upon this great system of circulation which involves our planet. We are now beginning to suspect, and perhaps justly, that the air around us, like the ocean, is able to take care of a certain amount of contamination. And if the contamination exceeds that amount, then the air itself becomes contaminated, and we have danger to life, because we cannot cleanse this circulation as rapidly as we pollute it. And the answer, perhaps, is a more organic process than our present scientific opinion might be. It is quite possible that we shall ultimately learn that in these ethers of space there are complete structures which can be studied physiologically if we have the faculties or instruments to measure them. Certainly the ancients held this to be distinctly true. So out of all of these wonders and mysteries of things come the first great continent of the earth. And a continent is a diffusion or distribution of habitable area, and usually ocean, or some form of, humanly speaking, uninhabitable area. And the first great division, which was to become the sustaining power of the first race of mankind, was the great Polarian diffusion, which is measured up to the time in which the Polarian geographical, geological distribution reached its zenith, or reached its maximum. In that time, we have what was called the first continent. And the first continent, in all probability, consisted of nearly the entire area of the earth. There was probably very little water as we know it, because the combustion and heat would have made water almost impossible. And from a philosophical standpoint, it is necessary that the first continent should have included every square inch of land that could possibly appear in any of the others. Because the first continent is archetypal. The first continent is the true continent. Just as the Adam Kadmon, or the archetypal man, is the total man. And humanity individualizes within him, but he is not divided. Thus, the first continent is the total continent of the earth. And continental forms change within that continent. But that continent never dies, never ceases, never ends, as long as the earth continues. All other continents are modifications of it. In the same way, the first race of men passed through all the modifications of the other seven, or the other six, major races, and the seven times seven sub-races. Yet the parent race never dies. Nor does the parent race retire into some far corner of the earth. The parent race is forever buried in its own progeny, forever continues through all the manifestations of itself. So the first continent continues always as the basic foundation of continents. And here the first species or type of life which we know gradually manifested itself. As we have a special discussion coming on another evening relating to the types of life developing on these continents, we want to limit our particular discussion tonight to the continental distribution itself. Now, in those days, such records as we know indicate that the Polarian epoch, which probably extended into a period of several hundred millions of years, that the Polarian epoch moved from the time when the first solid earth appeared until the maximum degree of surface crystallization was accomplished. This surface crystallization formed a crust of comparatively solid substance over the surface of this field of energy that was swirling as a flame in the center of the orbit of the planet. Later, this crystallization continued to go deeper, and we find the gradual formation of the Earth itself, the ancients telling us that in contradiction to the general belief of the geologists, that the hard core of the planet did not come first, but last. For the planet must do the same thing that everything else does. It becomes more and more formal as it descends into the crust which formed its surface. But within that surface is another solar system in reverse, moving toward the core of the planet. And this core of the planet, again, corresponds to space. It corresponds to the highest part of the solar system. So we have a very curious structure, and of course no one up to the present time has ever been able to explore the substance and elements composing the core of the planet. In any event, the Polarian species or period with its form of life supplied only a very uncertain environment for the development of living things. These living things had to be without any structural form such as we know. Therefore, they could leave no bones in the rocks. They could leave no fossil remains. They could leave no trace of artifact of any kind, because nothing could have survived the vicissitudes of heat and combustion that distinguished that era. Thus the ancients tell us that these creatures that were beginning to move into this fire mist were called children of the fire mist. They were like the Nibelungen people of the Nordic myths. They were creatures composed of luminous fiery bodies like the salamanders of legendary. They could live in the fire, just as surely as there are beings that can live in the combustion heat of the sun, but they are not like ourselves. But these bodies and souls living in the fire mist of the Polarian world had very slight environmental advantage. There was nothing they could do except to project forms from their own levels of consciousness. So in these creatures, as in the embryo, which recapitulates this whole early evolutionary process, the consciousness of the incarnating being was not in the body, but the body was a projection of that consciousness downward into a state of sleep. Thus, if the being that created the fire mist form or was projected into it had any awareness of it at all, it was the awareness of a sleeper imagining in his sleep that he was floating in flames. He would awaken periodically and find that he was awake in another world and it had only dreamed of the flames. Buddhism also points out the rather interesting possibility that all bodies, all informants, are a kind of dreaming. Certainly this would be the case in the primary structure of the Polarian epic. So these beings were simply learning how to manipulate the subtle substances of their world. Now when the world began to crystallize and grow more and more dense and physical, what happened to the fire mist? What happened to this luminous atmosphere that first bodies were composed of? It did not cease. This luminous fire mist retired into the arterial system and became the life of the blood. And the human blood, in the living body of a person, carries within it, in the deeper parts of it, the residual remains of the fire mist. It has to remain, just as man's facial structure still shows the rudiments of gills derived from the time when he had to live in an atmosphere that was mostly water. So all these ancient parts never die. They retire into specialized attributes and become associated with levels or degrees of man's present growth and culture. In the beginning of this period also, we see the beginning of the differentiation between fire and water. For gradually, this tremendous combustion, striking outer atmosphere, physically, coldness, the strange coldness of the cosmic night, seems to have produced a mysterious fluid out of space, a mysterious substance resident in the magnetic spheres of energy. And this was precipitated to form water. This water, as it precipitated, striking heat, gas, combustion, formed terrible outbursts and also masses of steam, as we find in the story of the Nordic sagas, where in Gnungagap, the cleft in space, the flame giants and the frost giants, through their elements, formed this terrible combustion, and from it was fashioned the body of Ymir, the frost giant of the ancient Scandinavian creation myth. In any event, gradually, this combination resulted in the rise of the second great order of the world. And from the Polarian cycle, or the Polarian distribution of continental area, came forth the Hyperborean, which was a Greek term meaning a land beyond or above the wind. It was generally assumed to be a land north of the habitable area which the Greeks recognized as their own homeland. But in the ancient philosophical concepts, the Hyperborean distribution, or the second great continental organization, was not due to something being added, but due to the fact that certain parts of the Polarian world sank. That is, they disappeared from the surface appearance of things, leaving the outlines of scattered continents. Other areas that had previously been one were broken or fragmented to form perhaps islands or smaller chains. And by degrees, this formation moving further southward, we find that water began to flow and mingle with land to begin the structure of oceans. These oceans in almost constant turmoil. These oceans filled with volcanic vents and horrible combustions constant, so that the surface of the earth was now no longer essentially covered with a strange fiery glow, but now with a white cloudy steam, ooze, a strange humidity filling everything. And it was this humid type of atmosphere which enabled the release of the plant germs that were later to become involved in the evolution of the planet. At that time also forms and organisms began to take on plant type of life. We are told in the ancient writings that the life at that time was reminiscent of what we would call fungus. It was this, like the great toadstools and mushrooms. But they were fantastic in shape, much more sensitive and highly organized than what we know today. And these forms of life grew quickly, grew some of them to considerable size, and were frequently destroyed in the tremendous combustions of nature. Therefore, forms were forever engendering and forever being destroyed. And in this procedure, the plant process of reproduction began to appear, because these forms had to reproduce or become extinct. And nature, never permitting the extinction of its purpose, began to create the problem of the seed, the possibility of these lives perpetuating themselves in one way or another. And in this we have the Hyperborean species, symbolically represented by blind giants, titanic forces, forces of tremendous strength and power, but with comparatively slight organization. Here also, beings about to form such bodies still were aware of them only as something outside of themselves, something seen in another level of dreaming. But now the dreaming was more vivid. Now the being became involved in his own dream, yet he could waken and discover himself back again in the celestial bridge, far above the seething, whirling world that was developing around him. This went on for a great period of time, and the combination of the cooling effects of these forces of humidity and water, the gradual development of what we call decay or disintegration, releasing life, plant life, we have the third distribution of continental area, which is called the Lemurian. Now, the Lemurian area was again a further shuffling of land arrangements. These were not continents like North America or South America, one of which went up and another one went down. They were complete distributions of the whole Earth's surface, with distribution of ocean and land, with seas and lakes and rivers, but with contours slightly different from those which we know today. Where we now have oceans, they had land. Where they had oceans, we have land. And the great area of the Lemurian culture, the area in which it seems to have developed itself most enormously, or to have reached its highest degree of attainment as a cultural zone, was this great area which we call now Gondwanaland, or the Australasian Archipelago, moving further over and including part of the islands of Ceylon and going on and on over to include Africa and part of Madagascar. It is an enormous land area. And this land area was the home of the transitional forms which began to develop into capacities to possess or hold life within themselves. It was at the time of the great Lemurian epoch, or the Lemurian age of the earth, that the first ensoulment, or the first true quickening of the human form took place. The early part of the Lemurian epoch was animal. And it was during this period that the great order of prehistoric monsters came into existence, as described by Bezoars in his Chaldean Cosmogony. Here, for reasons that become more apparent as we proceed, nature went on one of its strangest sprees to produce mosquitoes a foot and a half across, to produce bats with wingspreads of 20 feet, to produce, as the small school boy said, the great monster, the Brontosaurus, and his little brother, the Dinkysaurus. But in any event, it to produce all kinds of strange creatures. This was the time of the mastodon, this was the time of the pterodactyl, and all the weird beings and creatures of this nightmare. Creatures 60 feet long with brains no larger than those of birds. This was a strange world. But why did it happen? Are we going to find any reason that we can think of for this? One of the things that apparently was happening is that nature was beginning to move its resources toward the production of an instrument capable of being used for the total embodiment of the compound of mind, soul, emotion, and the body faculties or functions. To achieve this, nature apparently first permitted form to run wild. And then gradually, having built these tremendous bodies, nature then placed the seat of brain within them and began to draw upon them to support brain, until these bodies were gradually absorbed downward into approximately their present relationships, the body becoming more or less the nutritional field to feed the strange group of faculties and powers that were developing within the cranial structure. Now, at this time also, there are many legends and stories concerning the division which we call the missing link, and also the great question as to how a man was differentiated in this great geological process. Now, the fact of the matter seems to be, as we go back to the ancient writings, that whether we realize it or not, when a handful of seed, we will say, was cast into the abyss of earth in the beginning, there was more than one kind of seed. There were essentially four kinds of seed, representing four levels of incarnating beings from this atmospheric world of magnetism behind the invisible world. Now, as these seed fell into the environmental circumstances into which through which the earth was passing, each one of these types of seed reached its own degree of development and then individualized. The seed with the superior potential then continued its embryonic period for a longer time and then individualized. For instance, if you study the embryo of the human being and the chicken today, there is a period in which you cannot tell them apart. It is only after they have reached a certain degree that suddenly the chicken embryo stops growing and becomes a chicken and is born. The human embryo continues to develop.